funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. What motivated John Wilkes Booth to commit one of the most notorious crimes in American history? Abraham Lincoln was famously assassinated in a theater, a pastime he counted on to help relieve the terrible stress of leading the country through the Civil War. Theaters were also quite familiar to the man who took his life, as John Wilkes Booth had been struggling for years to make a name for himself as an actor, but apparently did not share his father and brother's legendary talents for the stage. Historian and author Nora Titone explores the tensions this created and their terrible consequences in her new book, My Thoughts Be Bloody, the bitter rivalry between Edwin and John Wilkes Booth that led to an American tragedy. Nora, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is a really ironic piece of history, given that in his own time, John Wilkes Booth absolutely stood in the shadows of his father and his brothers, but today it's his name that lives on.
Oh, it's extraordinary how kind of the looking glass of history has created this distortion. As time has passed, John Wilkes's crime towered over the reputations of his father and brother and really obliterated the story of the Booth family. They were the biggest name on the stage in the 19th century, and John Wilkes was really the least known of all his family of actors. So we've really lost an important chapter in not only the story of John Wilkes, but the story of that tragic moment that ended the Civil War.
So Junius Brutus Booth, who is the assassin's father, is really a fascinating figure in his own right. Tell us a little bit about his career as a Shakespearean actor.
Junius Brutus Booth was a native of London, and he was a genius. He was a friend of Lord Byron. As a very young man in his teens, he learned 10 languages and dazzled the city of London with his abilities as an actor. In fact, when he first performed Shakespeare, his interpretations of Richard III and other famous roles were so radical that he sparked riots in Covent Garden Theater. And he took this incredible talent, not only for language and for acting, but also he was brilliant in other ways. He was a poet. He was a playwright. He took this talent to the shores of America in 1821. He had to flee London, not because his career was going badly. In fact, he was at the peak of his career, but he had fallen in love with a woman who wasn't his wife, and he had to leave town. So he came to America, where he hoped to make a new beginning, start his acting career over again, and pass himself and his mistress off as a married couple in the United States. And they went on to have 10 children, including Edwin and John Wilkes Booth, yet they were all illegitimate.
Yeah, so he sort of secreted them away on this farm in Maryland. How well did he support them?
Well, that is a fascinating question. As Abraham Lincoln once said, along with genius sometimes goes a predilection for alcohol. Mm-hmm. And Junius Brutus Booth had a terrible drinking problem. He was a phenomenally popular and successful actor here in the United States. Presidents like John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, even Martin Van Buren, they adored Booth, and he was really a cultural hero. But there was also this kind of sad, commiserating understanding that Junius Brutus Booth, the great Shakespearean genius, was an inconsistent performer because he had a crippling addiction to alcohol. And so this meant that his family at times struggled because he would go touring, as actors did in the 19th century, traveling from New York City to New Orleans, from Cincinnati to Savannah, annually on steamboats and railroads and even by carriage or on foot. And because of his drinking problem, sometimes he wouldn't make it to his next engagement, or if he did get there, he would be unable to perform. So as they were growing up, Edwin Booth and John Wilkes Booth, they had a very tenuous existence financially. Sometimes the father sent money home, sometimes he didn't. And the family had to support itself by selling produce in the markets in Baltimore. And so it was a very difficult childhood for the Booth brothers.
When Junius was around and sober, what sort of political and emotional influence did he have on the family?
He was a radical. He was what we would call now an abolitionist. He opposed slavery completely. He rejected extraordinarily in the 19th century. He rejected Christianity and called himself a follower of Hinduism and Islam, which was a pretty radical position to take in the 1830s and 1840s in America. And he was also a vegetarian, which was as heretical in the 19th century as rejecting the Bible. In fact, Junius would make a spectacle of himself sometimes if he were in a restaurant where he would, for example, only order a potato or a dish of peas and a mug of beer. If he saw someone else in the restaurant eating an oyster, for example, he would scream murderer at them and make a scene. So he was really an eccentric. And people forgave him for these eccentricities because they saw them as signs of his brilliance. You know, how could someone be so gifted as Junius Brutus Booth without having some peculiarities or eccentricities? But he did teach his children to observe vegetarianism. He encouraged them to think freely. And he and his mistress, Marianne Holmes, refused to own slaves. And they tried to communicate those values to their children. And indeed, all of their children, with the exception of John Wilkes Booth, ultimately sided with the Union during the Civil War. And Edwin, John Wilkes' older brother, also was an abolitionist, like his father.
So where did those two fall in the family order of these 10 kids?
They were, the Booths had children in two waves over a period of roughly 20 years. Mm-hmm. And Edwin and John Wilkes fall in the second wave. They are the second and fourth youngest, respectively.
So how did it happen that of all the children, Edwin was chosen to go and sort of mind his father when he got to be just 11 years old, which seems awfully young to have this responsibility, but he was to travel with him, keep his drinking under control, and keep the finances in order?
Exactly. This is one of these Dickensian assignments that you see happening in 19th century theatrical families. As I said earlier, Junius Brutus Booth had this terrible drinking problem, and he was not only supporting his family of 10 children in the United States and his mistress, but he also had to send money to his wife, his legal wife, and their son, their legitimate son, who were still living in London. So he had a lot of demands on his finances, and that money had to keep coming in. So very early on, when Edwin Booth is only 11 years old, his mother urges him and orders him, really, to go out on the road with his father, this tormented, hard-drinking genius, travel with him nationally, north, south, east, and west, from theater to theater, for 10 months out of every year, keeping him sober, keeping him dressed for every performance. Edwin was like a watchdog, a valet, and a makeup artist combined. And he was really the only child that they could send. The other children were girls, and they had lost two sons to a cholera epidemic, and their eldest son had grown up and become an actor and kind of broken away from the family. So that just left Edwin and John Wilkes to choose from. There were 4 years between the brothers. Mm-hmm. Edwin was 11. John Wilkes was 7 at the time that a chaperone was needed for the father. So Edwin, in some ways, was the obvious choice because he was older. But also, Edwin was the one who had talent. Mm-hmm. And even though this was grueling work for a little boy to follow his father, keep him out of saloons, try to persuade him from picking up that bottle of brandy, saying, no, put it down, let's stay sober so you can go on tonight, Edwin also was learning how to be an actor. And this was, I think, a deliberate decision on the family's part. Acting was the family business. Junius Brutus Booth looked at his sons and chose the one child who seemed to have the most promise on stage, and that clearly was Edwin Booth. He was born with his father's dramatic spark. John Wilkes, by contrast, had no dramatic talent, and the family could see it early on. They even called him the dullard, apparently, because he had no linguistic ability. He didn't have a good memory, unlike Edwin, who had a tremendous vocabulary and almost a photographic memory early on, which is what you need as a Shakespearean actor, to memorize those long soliloquies and to carry dozens of plays in your head so you can perform them night after night wherever you are on the road.
So at least in the early years, this is pretty awful for Edwin, but it must have sounded very glamorous to a kid like John Wilkes Booth.
Oh, indeed. John Wilkes Booth, as everyone remembers him as a child, hungered and thirsted for adventure. And remember, if Edwin was off on the road with his father, however difficult that job was, and how, and it did leave its mark on Edwin. You know, he said he lost his childhood through this apprenticeship, that he was working, 15, 16-hour days from the age of 11 onward. But to John Wilkes Booth, as he told his family, his brother going off traveling with their father, John Wilkes considered that, quote-unquote, a golden holiday. Because it was a ticket out of school, and John Wilkes Booth hated school. He was a very bad student, but his mother insisted that he go to boarding schools and finishing academies where he would learn to be a proper gentleman. And he despised that assignment. But it also would get him away from the scandal in Baltimore, which by this time was public knowledge, of being the illegitimate son of Junius Brutus Booth and his mistress, Marianne Holmes. Because by the time this division of the brothers gets made, the scandal about the Booths not being married and their children being illegitimate had become public knowledge. So part of Edwin's golden holiday was that going on the road nationally with his father, he escapes the taunts, the public humiliation, and just the repercussions of that adultery scandal that John Wilkes Booth felt every day on the streets of Baltimore as he was growing up.
You know, it's interesting, Nora. I don't want to defend either alcoholism or adultery, but it does strike me that if Junius Booth had been born maybe 150 years later, he would have fit right in Hollywood.
Oh, this story seems so familiar to us. You know, it could be a tabloid story anywhere today, anytime in the 21st or 20th centuries. He really, you're absolutely right, and his radicalism and his bohemianism, it almost seems like a story from the 1960s or even from today.
So let's talk about the education of John Wilkes Booth. His mother sacrificed money that could have been spent on other things in the household to make sure he got a good education. She seems to have made a poor choice in terms of sending him off to military school.
Yes, indeed. She sends him, part of the reason why Edwin Booth needs to go on the road. Not only are there children to feed and, supplies to be bought, but there is tuition to be paid. And the reason Marianne Holmes, the mother of these Booth children, was so intent on educating John Wilkes is that not only was it a black mark against you in the 19th century if you were illegitimate, but it was also, if this is possible, an even bigger black mark to be a member of an actor's family. Mm-hmm. Actors were one of the lowest professions on the totem pole. They were social outcasts. They were seen as disreputable, morally questionable, even dangerous people to associate with because what they were doing on stage, nightly displaying their bodies for money, was seen as, it was almost like it was witchcraft, turning your character into somebody else for a night. It was just seen as very disreputable work. And what Marianne Holmes wanted to do was lift the social status of her children. So they made great sacrifices to send John Wilkes to a military academy in rural Maryland called St. Timothy's.
Now, we'll talk about what that did to his character in just a moment.
Sure.
We need to take a quick break. My guest this hour is historian and author Nora Titone. Her new book is called My Thoughts Be Bloody, The Bitter Rivalry Between Edwin and John Wilkes Booth That Led to an American Tragedy.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian and author Nora Titone. Her new book is called My Thoughts Be Bloody, The Bitter Rivalry Between Edwin and John Wilkes Booth That Led to an American Tragedy. So, Nora, John Wilkes Booth goes off to military school, albeit pretty briefly, and lo and behold, all the cool kids are the sons of wealthy white Southern planters.
Exactly. And what happens here, this is really a dramatic moment in the history of the Booth family. And again, it adds to this idea of John Wilkes that his brother was able to have a golden holiday while John Wilkes was sentenced to something much more difficult. The father, Junius Brutus Booth, and the son, Edwin, the older brother of John, go to California as part of the gold rush, the same year that John Wilkes Booth is sent to this very regimented and strict boarding academy. He's not very happy to be at military school, but as you say, this is where he comes into the circle of the influences that are going to dominate his young manhood. These sons of Maryland gentry, slave owners' sons, who are really high in the social echelons in Maryland, and John Wilkes wants to join them. And he is very influenced by these friendships. Meanwhile, his father and older brother go to California, and tragically, the father dies on the return journey. It's a very perilous journey to get from the East Coast to the new state of California in the early 1850s. You had to hike across the Isthmus of Panama through jungles that were perilous places filled with cholera, filled with bandits, and Junius Brutus Booth doesn't survive the return journey. And so this one figure in John Wilkes' life, who was an abolitionist, who perhaps might have instructed his son in a different way, is removed from John Wilkes' life by 1852.
By that time, Edwin Booth was sort of successful in his own right as an actor. Is that right?
Absolutely. He is a dramatic prodigy. And this is part of the difficulty in the relationship between these two interesting brothers. Edwin Booth was only 4 years older than John, but his genius and his talent on stage was so extraordinary and so instantly recognizable to whoever saw him that he rocketed to fame, national fame, while he was still a teenager. And so by the time he's 19 or 20, Edwin Booth, you know, his father is dead by this point, he's a national figure. He's nationally known, and he's earning tremendous amounts of money. By the time he's in his early 20s, he's earning the equivalent of $500,000 a year, which is truly an extraordinary sum. And at the same time, John Wilkes Booth, who wants to have a career on stage like his father, like his older brother, even though he's never been trained and everyone in the family tries to talk him out of it, he is not making such a success. And in fact, he's only working as an extra while his older brother is finding fame and fortune as a star.
And in fact, the first time John Wilkes Booth took the stage, he was laughed off.
Oh, it was a humiliating moment. This is in Philadelphia in 1858, and he goes on stage in a melodrama called Lucretia Borgia, and he's supposed to say a very complicated line. He has maybe five lines in the play, and it's at the most crucial moment of the play. It's a tragic culmination of all of these plot lines. And John Wilkes Booth can't speak his line properly. He flubs it. The entire theater howls with laughter, and the play is ruined. And in fact, that moment was so, the audience resented the way John Wilkes ruined that moment so much that the next night when he came on in a different play, they booed him off the stage and wouldn't let the play go on until John Wilkes was removed from the story.
Nora Titone is my guest. Her new book is called My Thoughts Be Bloody. Let's go on the phones now to Tom in Arlington. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading your book, and I'm wondering if you're familiar with a short story by Karen Joy Fowler that's just come out in the last year called Booth's Ghost, and it covers much of the ground you're talking about the Booth brothers and the Hamlet aspect, and because she's writing really speculative fiction, she really emphasizes the ghost aspect, how they were both haunted by their father, and then John Wilkes was haunted by Edwin's talent, and what might have happened if maybe John Wilkes had the acting talent. Are you familiar with her work or that story?
I am not, but it sounds fascinating.
I can tell you right now, I heard an early draft read aloud at Clarion West Writer Workshop in Seattle last year. I was attending as a student, and she was really into it. And I'm thinking she's either already bought your book. If you haven't spoken to her, I bet you she contacts you at some point because you seem to have such a similar interest to you from historical nonfiction and her, you know, writing speculative fiction, but she researched it heavily. She was completely immersed in it. And I highly recommend her story. It's in an anthology right now called What I Didn't See. It's just a short story, but you know, she wrote the Jane Austen Book Club, and I think you'll really like it, and you two should get together.
Well, thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah, perhaps there's a partnership down the line somewhere.
Okay,
so not only was John Wilkes Booth a bad actor, he was such a bad actor, Nora, that Edwin didn't want him to use the family name?
That's right. He wanted him to be J.B. Wilkes, because the Booth name was a commodity in this country, and there were dollar signs attached to being a Booth. Their father's fame had been so extraordinary, and Edwin was building such a sterling reputation that to have an untalented Booth, someone who was awkward, who earned hisses and boos on stage, it might tarnish the family brand, as it were. So Edwin instructed John Wilkes, because by this time, Edwin, with the father dead, Edwin was really the head of the family, even though he was very, very young. And he was supporting the family. He was supporting their mother and their other siblings. So he had a great deal of power. And he was able to say to John, no, you can't use the last name Booth. You have to be J.B. Wilkes. And this changes in 1860, ironically, the year that the country is splitting apart, right on the verge of civil war. This is the year that after 3 years of being an apprentice, John Wilkes finally says to Edwin, please, I want to try my hand as a star. I want to try to go out there and play Hamlet and play Richard III. And Edwin says to him, all right, you may do so, and you may use the last name Booth. However, you may only tour in the South. The North is mine. He splits the country right along the Mason-Dixon line for business reasons, because in the North, you have cities like Philadelphia, New York, and Boston, where theater audiences are huge, where profits are immense. In the South, it's a little harder to make a living as an actor because cities are farther apart and audiences are smaller.
And one of the things that Edwin was doing, in addition to being a big star, was he was starting to really transcend that line into social respectability. He was, in fact, invited to dine with people of power, and they were not ashamed to have him over.
This is the most amazing leap. You're absolutely right. Edwin Booth becomes the first actor to cross that line of social prejudice that kept stage stars away from polite society. And what's really extraordinary is that in 1864, Edwin Booth is invited to Washington, D.C. to perform for the third anniversary of President Lincoln's inauguration. He is the star of the city for these inaugural anniversary festivities. The president and first lady come to see Edwin Booth perform for 6 nights. They give him standing ovations. And at the end of that tremendously successful run, and really a state occasion where the cabinet and the diplomatic corps join Lincoln in the theater to see Edwin Booth act, Edwin is invited to dine with the Secretary of State, William H. Seward, in Seward's mansion. And this is a historic first for an actor to be brought in to sit at the table of power and respectability.
And Seward's daughter, who was a young woman at the time, seems to have developed quite a crush on Edwin.
Oh, a huge crush. Her diary of his visit to the Seward home, her entry for that night runs 35 pages, whereas she gives only a few lines to Lincoln himself and to General Grant. So, yes, she was completely starstruck. And it is quite tragic to read that diary because, of course, a year later, who comes to the Seward home with a weapon, a conspirator, a co-conspirator of John Wilkes Booth, who comes to the Seward house while John Wilkes is shooting Lincoln in Ford's Theater. This co-conspirator comes to the Seward's mansion, stabs the Secretary of State, throws Fanny Seward, the young girl who wrote the diary entry, to the ground and terrifies her, and she witnesses her father being attacked.
Nora Tytone is my guest. Her new book is called My Thoughts Be Bloody, The Bitter Rivalry Between Edwin and John Wilkes Booth That Led to an American Tragedy. Nora, why, when the Civil War broke out, did John Wilkes Booth not quit his very unsuccessful campaign to be a star and just join the Confederate Army?
That's a fascinating question. His sympathies were completely engaged on the side of the Confederacy. And as I said, he was the only member of his family to feel that way. The rest of the Booths were completely with the Union As I mentioned, Edwin is performing for Lincoln. He's honored to do so. He adored Lincoln, and he was indeed even friends with Julia Ward Howe, the abolitionist who wrote the Battle Hymn of the Republic. So all the other Booths are wholly Unionists. John Wilkes is engaged with the South. He could have enlisted, and he even contemplated enlisting. He was in Baltimore in April of 1861 when many of his classmates were joining the Confederate Army, his classmates from this military school, St. Timothy's. But he doesn't, because he has a golden opportunity. For the first time in John Wilkes' struggling career as an actor, his older brother Edwin is leaving the country. Just as war breaks out, Edwin decides to go to London and Paris, where he's going to try to solidify his reputation before European audiences. And this leaves John Wilkes Booth with an open map. He can now perform wherever he wants. He can perform in New York, in Boston, in Philadelphia, in any northern city, because his big brother is not there to stop him or discourage him. And so it is a rare opportunity for him to try to make his name as a star. And that's the main reason he does not enlist in the Confederacy in April 1861.
Are there newspaper accounts at the time of people feeling sort of duped, that they heard that a famous Booth was going to be performing in their city and they went and bought tickets, and then instead of Edwin they get John Wilkes?
Oh, the reviews, Chris, are scathing. They are scathing. I mean, if you read what people write, they'll say, you know, there is no excuse for this kind of spectacle being brought before a New York audience, for example, when John Wilkes makes his debut in New York City. He was a bruising fighter. He was able to generate excitement on stage with his sword, but not with language and not with acting ability. People talk about how difficult it was to listen to John deliver Shakespeare, because he didn't know where to breathe. He'd never been trained. It would be like you or I getting up on stage with a cast of professional actors and trying to act, you know, without any classes, without any preparation. So he was truly, people considered him a stuntman. But as an actor, he was an imposter, and critics made that very clear.
Don't you wish that you could somehow see a videotape of these two brothers and compare them for yourself?
Well, you know, it became... We can get almost to that comparative experience. There is a recording of Edwin Booth's voice that does exist. It was made in 1890 on a wax cylinder, so it's a very scratchy and primitive type of recording.
Yeah.
But what's amazing about it is that we can kind of make that comparison using historical documents. So we have a recording of Edwin Booth's voice. I've listened to it, and you can even listen to it online, I think, through the Smithsonian website. But he sounds like an Englishman. He sounds incredibly modern. He has an English accent. So he almost sounds like Laurence Olivier or Jude Law. He's performed Shakespeare very naturally, in a conversational tone. It's beautiful. It's soaring. It's genius. John Wilkes, we have vivid descriptions of how he performed. People said he spoke like a guy from the east side of Baltimore. He didn't deliver Shakespeare like a British man, the way Edwin had been trained to do by their London-born father. Because John Wilkes lacked that training, he spoke Shakespeare like an American guy from Baltimore. And so his pronunciation suffered. And because he didn't parse the meaning of the soliloquies, he would just emphasize the most bloody or violent word in whatever line he was delivering. And so nothing ever made any sense. So we can kind of reconstruct what it would be like.
By the way, talk about the origin of your title, My Thoughts Be Bloody.
That is a line from Hamlet. It is a line that Hamlet delivers towards the end of the play when he's finally resolved to take action. He says, remember, Hamlet has been dithering throughout the play. What should I do? What should I do? Finally says, from this time forth, my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worse. And he picks up his sword and goes to fight the final battle that ends the play.
Hmm.
And I chose that title because it captures that break in the brothers' relationship that you see coming in 1864, when John Wilkes Booth finally, after struggling throughout the war years to make a success on stage, gives up as an actor. This is the year, Edwin performs for Abraham Lincoln in the White House. At the National Theater, he performs for the President and Mrs. Lincoln. And this is the year that Edwin acquires his own theater on Broadway, the Winter Garden, that he turns into a fundraising engine for the Union war effort. He raises thousands of dollars for the Union, for U.S. military hospitals with this theater. And it's also the year where John Wilkes Booth stops being able to make a good living on stage. His brother has returned from Europe. He's doing booming business. And John Wilkes can't earn as much money as he would like. And he goes prospecting for oil, actually, in western Pennsylvania in the spring of 1864, trying to get rich quick. When that scheme fails and his oil wells run dry, politics, which has always been a passion for him, becomes the main thing in his life, and that's when he's recruited in the summer of 1864 to join the Confederate Secret Service.
Historian and author Nora Titone is my guest. Her new book is called My Thoughts Be Bloody, The Bitter Rivalry Between Edwin and John Wilkes Booth That Led to an American Tragedy.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian and author Nora Titone. Her new book is called My Thoughts Be Bloody, The Bitter Rivalry Between Edwin and John Wilkes Booth That Led to an American Tragedy. So, Nora, was John Wilkes Booth recruited into the Confederate Secret Service with the express intention of setting up this conspiracy to kill President Lincoln?
As far as we know, absolutely not. That the plan originally was to kidnap him. Mm-hmm. And what's really fascinating is that this is unfolding over the summer of 1864 and the early fall of 1864. And what John Wilkes Booth tells his family, of course, he's taken this job from the Confederate Secret Service, and he's being paid because we have records of the money he deposits in banks in Washington, D.C. to get the conspiracy going. He tells his family that he's quitting the stage to focus on oil prospecting. As I mentioned earlier, he had three wells in western Pennsylvania in a region called Petrolia, or Oil Dorado, and he told his family that he'd make more money by being an oil prospector than by being an actor, and they all believed him because, of course, they knew that he wasn't doing well on stage, so they thought this was a good move. But what happens, and this is what's so fascinating, is that Edwin Booth, in November of 1864, decides to grab attention in New York City with a spectacular production of Julius Caesar, Shakespeare's assassination tragedy. He wants his brother John Wilkes to be in it. He wants John Wilkes to play Mark Antony. Edwin will play Brutus. This will grab the attention of New York. It drove thousands of people to the Winter Garden, Edwin's theater. And all the proceeds from this play would go to a fund to erect a statue of Shakespeare in Central Park, and that statue actually still stands today. So the brothers are acting together for that one night on the stage of the Winter Garden Theater in Broadway. And the outcome of that is that the brothers have a terrible, terrible fight. That very night, this is November 25th, 1864, Confederate secret agents attack New York City. It's a little-known fact. There was an arson attack on New York by Confederate agents. They tried to burn down 15 hotels in Manhattan all at once on the stroke of 9 o'clock at night. And as the brothers are acting at the Winter Garden Theater, fire alarms go off, and even firemen come into the theater to check for flames. And the brothers, arguing the next morning about what has happened, because, of course, the newspapers are filled with the rebel attack on New York City, have a terrible fight about politics, where John Wilkes says, of course Confederates have the right to attack New York. Look at what the Union Army is doing in Virginia, attacking farms. And Edwin says, you are a treasonous rebel. Leave my house. And he throws John Wilkes out onto the street. And it is after that that John Wilkes, you know, the conspiracy goes into higher gear, and he tries to recruit actors from his brother's theater, the Winter Garden, to participate in the kidnapping of Abraham Lincoln.
Let's speak with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. Here we have in one family, exactly, it's so current, this discussion, because, you know, the line between fame and infamy is even more blurry now than it was then, thanks to the media. I was hoping the guests could talk about, you know, here we have in one family both sides of that coin, and I was wondering if you could talk about that tendency for human beings to want that attention. And what did you come to learn about this human need for attention to be noticed?
Ken, that's an amazing question. If you read the papers of the Booth family, and I was able to go to this extraordinary club in Manhattan that Edwin founded, and he left all of his papers there, and even his father's papers. It's extraordinary reading because the Booths were obsessed with fame. They were obsessed with genius and with the rewards of genius, money and national renown. And you're absolutely right. One brother famous, the other infamous. And what you see happening is that after John Wilkes does his crime in Ford's Theater, a crime that I believe he hoped would make him a hero, would draw attention to himself, Edwin tries to outpace his brother's notoriety, his brother's infamy, by becoming even greater than ever before. So initially he says, I'm going to retire from the stage because my brother killed the president. I'm going to, as an act of penance, I'll never act again. I will give up my ambition for fame. That promise, which he makes in the pages of several American newspapers over the summer of 1865, does not last. 6 months after Lincoln's body is entombed at Springfield, Edwin Booth goes back on stage, and he becomes more toweringly famous than ever before. By the end of his career, he is the friend of American President Grover Cleveland. Cleveland helps Edwin create a club in Manhattan called the Players. J.P. Morgan joins this club. Mark Twain joins this club. It's an extraordinary gathering of the most talented and wealthy men in the United States. It's founded in 1888, and the purpose of that club is to honor Edwin Booth. And every New Year's Eve, the glittering membership, including Mark Twain and Grover Cleveland, J.P. Morgan, all these towering figures, they get together and they toast Edwin Booth in person. And so you see this hunger in the Booth family so great that it's driving Edwin to achieve colossal renown even after his brother commits one of the most notorious crimes in our history.
Do you think Edwin Booth enjoyed feeling that people were in sympathy with him and sort of understood it wasn't his fault?
You know, it's really incredible how few people blamed Edwin for what had happened. And there was really no clear way that they could have. Mm-hmm. Other members of the family, however, were jailed on suspicion of aiding and abetting John Wilkes Booth. The brother's sister, Asia, was put under house arrest their older sibling, June Booth, was sent to the old Capitol prison in Washington. Edwin, however, remained completely untouched by suspicion, largely because his great friend, Julia Ward Howe, the abolitionist and author of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, had hundreds of letters from him that were able to document the fact that he was a loyal Union man. Similarly, Edwin's best friend was the secretary to Union General Ulysses S. Grant, and there were also letters that this friend had, you know, he's in Grant's office, he can give these to General Grant, that proved that Edwin was a loyal man. So really people rallied around Edwin because he was the great artist of his generation. He was a loyal Union man. He was an admirer of Lincoln. And so there was never any scandal attached to him after the assassination.
Given that the original plan was to kidnap President Lincoln, why did John Wilkes Booth kill him instead?
This is a challenging question. A friend of the Booth family called the mind of John Wilkes Booth in those weeks and months before the assassination. He called John Wilkes Booth's mind a vortex of hell-born dreams.
Hmm.
He said this was an inscrutable, chaotic mind. And I find that phrase very helpful because, of course, as historians, we can't know for certain why a historical figure, chose to do what they did. But in seeking to understand what was in that vortex of hell-born dreams, you know, all we can do is look at that moment that he created, that tragic, cataclysmic, violent interruption that he choreographed onto the stage of Ford's Theater, breaking into the play Our American Cousin with this very dramatic leap off the balcony, the shot, the leap, and then his running across the stage shouting, "Seek Semper Tyrannis." Everyone who watched that moment in the theater, everyone who left, you know, eyewitness testimony, indicated that they believed John Wilkes was acting in that moment, and that he was, what he planned to do in the theater was so dramatic and so theatrical that at first people thought it was part of the play. So you see him using the tools of the theater in the most dramatic way possible, and it's helpful to look at all of these things to try to understand what he was thinking about in that moment.
We have an email here, let's see if I can find it, asking about, from David in Plano, about the amount, or rather lack of protection that presidents had prior to the 20th century. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, certainly in that moment in 1865, that night, April 14, everyone's attention was on stage. And that vulnerability that we see in Ford's Theater that night, some people write about the fact that there was a man who was supposed to be standing guard outside the door of the president's box, but instead he was watching the play on stage along with everyone else. I think that actors, right after the assassination, were very concerned as a class that they would be blamed for having unwittingly, as it were, participated in that tragedy because that spectacle on stage was so powerful and so entertaining that no one's mind was on a threat at all. They were engrossed with what was unfolding on stage.
John Wilkes Booth, of course, was executed in pretty short order after the assassination. Did he and Edwin ever exchange a word after the assassination?
No, they did not. In fact, it's really one of the most moving things to read, and it's very dramatic, it's very arresting, is to read the conversations of the family that took place during those nearly 2 weeks when John Wilkes Booth was on the run after shooting Lincoln. As we know, he was on the run through Virginia before he was hunted down by federal agents and shot. The Booth family, at that time, they were in New York in Edwin's mansion, and they were waiting. They were keeping vigil. No one in the family wanted him to be taken alive, and the family papers reflected this. They hoped he would be shot. What they did not want was a trial and a hanging, because that, for them, would be the most painful of all.
Can you talk about how you decided to tell this story? It seems like there is a wealth of material that not a whole lot of historians have done much with, at least in terms of putting out a book for popular audiences.
You're absolutely right. This club I talked about in New York, the Players, that Edwin Booth established with the help of Mark Twain and President Grover Cleveland, it's an extraordinary archive in and of itself. There is just a vast treasure trove of Booth family papers there that haven't been looked at in generations and that tell the story and that represent the relationship between these two brothers. that has never really been grappled with in tremendous detail. And the sources themselves, Chris, are so compelling. I mean, these diaries, these letters, they just smolder. The Booths were very expressive. They were an extremely dysfunctional family. They wrote a great deal. Many members of the family left terrific papers. And so it was going to this club, where historians rarely go to do research, as well as to other places in the United States where Booth family manuscripts can be found. I found that for years and years and years, few people had been on this trail. Most people who investigate John Wilkes Booth and the assassination stick to what's in the National Archives, to what's in the Library of Congress. Those are where the military records are found. But what I was following were the family papers, and they are in theater history libraries because, of course, this was a clan of actors.
Well, it does seem that your approach makes it difficult to, I don't think I'll forget a lot of the things that I learned reading this book.
Well, it is, you know, the Booths were at the center of so many events in the 19th century. You know, their story begins here in the 1820s, and it lasts through to the 1890s, to the end of Edwin's life, as he's, you know, living out his final years in glittering splendor with J.P. Morgan in this terrific club in Manhattan. And the Booths are one way of getting at America's story in the 19th century. They participate in the gold rush, in the settlement of the West. Booth family members are present at John Brown's execution, and of course, at Ford's Theater in 1865. So they're almost a very dramatic vehicle for telling our country's story in the 19th century.
Nora Titone's new book is called My Thoughts Be Bloody, The Bitter Rivalry Between Edwin and John Wilkes Booth That Led to an American Tragedy. Nora, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Chris. It was a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.